This podcast is produced by the Center for Deployment Psychology at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. In addition, references to any specific companies, products, processes, or services does not necessarily constitute or imply endorsement by the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. Welcome to CDP's podcast, Practical for Your Practice,
where we give you actionable intel to support what you do, one colleague to another. Hello, everybody, and welcome to CDP's Practical for Your Practice podcast. I'm Corinne Lefkowitz, and I'm joined today with my friend and co-host, Dr. Kevin Holloway. How are you, Kevin?
Hey, Corinne. I'm doing all right. I'm looking forward to our episode today, but generally speaking, kind of even keeling it.
Even keeling it.
Yeah,
well, I think you might be doing better than me. I have to admit that I'm excited about this episode, but I'm also equal parts kind of anxious or uncomfortable because we're going to be talking about a topic that in my mind makes me anxious and uncomfortable, which is probably why we should have the conversation. But we are going to be talking about gun safety and lethal means reduction with patients and how to get a little bit better with that. So it's a topic that makes me anxious.
Yeah,
because I don't feel good or confident about it. But the good news is that we have an expert on with us today to help me feel better and maybe even our listeners.
Which is the purpose of this.
That's the point of the podcast, is to make Corinne feel better. but maybe also some listeners will feel better as well. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome our guest, Dr. Kurt West.
Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
We're so glad to have you here to help us with this discussion that obviously I'm a little bit uncomfortable with, and I would like to think I'm not the only one. So I hope that you're going to ease that discomfort a little bit.
no pressure.
No pressure at all. I mean, just a friendly conversation. But maybe we can start by having you introduce yourself to our listeners and telling them how you got here.
Sure. I'm Kurt West. I am an associate professor of psychiatry and the vice chair for research in the Department of Psychiatry at the Uniformed Services University, which also makes me a scientist at the Center for the Study of Traumatic Stress. Mm. I am a retired Navy psychiatrist. So much of my career has been both at Walter Reed, but also out in the operating forces with 1st Marine Division. So I came to this topic of firearm safety, particularly firearm safety as a means of suicide prevention, about 10 years ago, where I became part of a project we had here at the center, working with creating just education training materials for Army reservists returning from deployment, to educate them about storing firearms safely in their homes, both as a means of preventing suicide, but also preventing injury in the household. And since then, have continued work in that sphere, and we'll talk more about that as we go on.
Such important work too, right? As service members are returning from deployment, just talking about, there's so many things they get hit with, lots of questions about health across the spectrum, and having that conversation, so important. So for our listeners, one of the ways that we came across Dr. West's work, not just that we're all at the same university, but also he's got a podcast or was doing a podcast. Is it currently? Are you still producing the podcast?
So we just wrapped production. We completed 2 seasons. Mm-hmm. And the podcast is called Let's Talk About Your Guns. And the idea behind this was we wanted people to be having more conversations about the importance of storing firearms securely at home as a means of preventing suicide. Now, that seems a little, that I can see Corinne getting a little uncomfortable already. No, the idea is, let me walk it back a step.
Okay.
The idea, most of us, when we think suicide prevention, right, And we're talking to clinical people here. When we think suicide prevention, we're thinking identifying those individuals who are at risk, figuring out
Right.
how at risk they are, where are they along the suicide risk continuum, and then applying the right intervention to be able to bring them back from that risk.
Right.
Firearm safety is agnostic to risk. And the idea is this is an environmental intervention that creates a safer environment because we don't always know when risk is going to appear. And it may not show up in front of us in a clinical setting. They may
Yeah.
be fine in their visit with us one day, and 3 days later, they encounter whatever it is that makes it the worst day of their life. And they didn't see it coming. We didn't see it coming. The idea is, though, if that firearm is stored securely, then we have some time and space between that impulse and a fatal act.
Absolutely. And it occurs to me as you were describing that, the idea that, oftentimes we think of suicide prevention as assessing and assigning risk and then applying an intervention. It occurs to me that we're not great at predicting who or when somebody may attempt suicide. And so this approach of like, we really need to be thinking about the environment, that their surroundings, their access to means, regardless of risk, is really important
Well,
here.
and I think the key thing is, right, it's not necessarily just that we're not great at assessing risk, but risk always, we're not always there. I
Right.
mean, I always tell myself if I spend 30 minutes with a patient every 4 weeks, that's a whole lot of other time that they're not with me that I may have no influence over them. But if I did say something to them in that 30 minutes that got them to either unload their gun, put a locking device on it, put it in a lockbox, put the ammunition somewhere else. Anything that puts that time and space, again, if even if they never come back and tell me that that happened, they're still alive.
And not only are we spending so little time, but that risk fluctuates over time too. It may fluctuate quite a bit between even weekly sessions.
I actually saw something in an article that just came across my desk, put out by APA recently, that was all about reducing risk through safe firearm ownership. And one of the paragraphs really stuck out to me, so I'm just going to quote it, and we'll put the link in the show notes. But the article said, "Society expects mental health professionals to anticipate these crises and intervene before it's too late. After all, people trust mechanics to keep their brakes from failing and primary care doctors to catch developing illnesses. But suicidal crises can emerge suddenly, making it difficult to predict when someone will attempt to take their own life, according to psychologists who study suicidality." And of course, Dr. West, I'd lump you in that category of psychologists who study suicidality. So it seems like the message is clear across the board that there's a limit to how much we can predict despite our best efforts, and that we're probably well suited to make recommendations that will help when we're not there.
Yeah, and I think the thinking that's evolving, right, is people will say, oh, we've been pouring enormous resources into suicide prevention for 20 years and we haven't moved the needle. I don't believe that that's true. I think we've developed a much richer understanding about suicide risk, but not only that, the transition from suicidal ideation to intent to action.
Right.
And so that is a great advance in understanding suicide, but at the same time, we are realizing that there's this whole other dimension of impulsive suicide, particularly related to firearms, where the idea of finding and assigning risk and intervening, there's just no time. And so creating safer environments is one of the key interventions that's going to make a difference in that. I always liken it to, the idea of seat belts, right? And people in the firearm safety world use the seat belt analogy all the time. But my colleague Adam Walsh, he gave me this analogy, which was nobody expects to hit black ice when they're out driving. And but we wear our seat belts anyway, because the time to go reaching for the seat belt is not the minute that you see that black ice, because there's just no time.
Exactly. Well, let me ask you this though, right? So thinking of things from a environmental safety perspective, there are lots and lots and lots and lots of ways that people could attempt to die by suicide. There are lots of means they could, utilize. Why focus on guns? Why is that important?
Because firearms are at a minimum 85% lethal in suicide attempts, far more than any other means. So, suffocation, hanging, the lethality is more on the order of 50% or less. So, many people will survive those attempts. But once somebody takes a loaded firearm and directs it at themselves, there's an 85% chance that they will not survive that episode. That's why we focus on firearms.
That's significant. And for the populations of active duty service members, veterans, it seems to me like access is also really an important issue. Like for those who are currently serving, that's sometimes part of the job is to have access to firearms. They're very familiar with and comfortable with firearms. Many veterans continue to own firearms privately after their service. Not only is it highly, highly lethal, but also the access to such a lethal means seems to be higher among those populations as well. Is that accurate, or am I kind of making that up?
So, firearm ownership, as far as we can tell, is slightly more prevalent amongst military members and veterans. So, on the order of 50% of households would have firearms amongst military and veteran families versus around 40% for the general population. Just say that's a slight difference.
Sure, yeah.
And you're absolutely correct that the typical military and veteran firearm household has familiarity with the fundamentals of firearm safety. We are still learning about what those behaviors are in terms of whether they store guns securely or not. So that's an ongoing area of research.
So I have to say that's one of the things that makes me anxious about this conversation, the sense that working with service members and veterans who certainly are probably way more comfortable with firearms than I am, and I assume have far more training in using them safely and effectively, for me to come in and have this conversation about it sometimes feels uncomfortable, right? Because that I assume that they're more skilled and knowledgeable and safer than I would worry about. So I'm just disclosing part of where my anxiety comes from.
Well, so I think we do know that one of the barriers for clinical people to talk to patients about firearms and safety is that we feel like we don't know, we're not a credible messenger. And that is often the case. One of the things that it's really incumbent upon us to do. So you could say the same thing about gender nonconforming individuals. Like, I don't know anything about X, Y, or Z. It's incumbent upon us then to become culturally competent, right? It doesn't mean we experience the culture, we're a part of the culture, but we are at least competent. I think the same thing applies to firearm owners, or what however you want to define it. But so there actually is a great resource to help people understand the fundamentals of firearms, what they are, what are the terminologies used, and it's called the Bullet Points Project. And they actually have a great website. It's Bullet Points Project, or yeah, it's bulletpointsproject.org. And it's designed for clinicians to
Like me.
understand, yeah, to understand it. It's to educate yourself. So I've that's a resource I came across. It's been around a few years now, and it's kept up to date. So a great place to get information.
Well, I guess that's where I'll be starting. And I know what I'll be doing when we wrap up this episode today. But since we have you here with your expertise, I'm going to take advantage of that. Could you tell us some about what are some of the interventions, some of the points that you're making with clients when you're talking about firearm safety?
So, number one is understanding what I call the five principles of secure storage. And that is every gun should be stored unloaded. That's number one. They should be stored in a locked container. They should be either taken apart or have a disabling device engaged. And then ammunition should be stored and locked separately. The final piece is that every gun owner should have a plan to store their firearms somewhere else if they hit a time of crisis. And so those are the things that I would go over with a patient if they, most gun owners know this, but I would sort of reiterate as a clinician to say, okay, you've got you told me that you've got guns at home. Can you tell me how they're stored? I'll hear that back. And then if I'm not hearing those four things, then it becomes a dialogue about, well, help me understand. Help me understand your reasons for storing the way that you do. And where can we move this towards safer storage, right? And then for everybody, it's like, well, do you have a plan? You're coming to see me. I'm a mental health provider, right? You're coming to see me. The assumption is something's not right. It may not be a crisis, but something's not right. And the likelihood that you might hit a crisis at some point in the future, maybe a little higher than the average person walking in off the street. And so let's think about what's that plan. If for some reason the things that we're doing aren't helping and things are getting worse, or whatever the straw that breaks the camel's back shows up next week, what can you do with your guns? And so talking through that with them.
I know you're mentioning self-harm, but I know from listening to a couple of episodes of the Let's Talk About Your Guns podcast that also this discussion can ultimately lead to the safety of other people in the household or other people that the patient, the identified patient, is friends with or is close to.
So you're hitting on a great motivator. As a matter of fact, when I think about this process of talking to patients about getting guns more secure in their house, one of the very consistent and positive motivators is if there are children in the house. And it's the idea that no child, no adolescent should be able to get unsupervised access to a firearm in their home, period. I mean, there's just no argument there. And so that can be, the clinician, you may be worried that I have some significant concerns that at some point this person may use the gun on themselves. But the thing that motivates them to lock it up is, but I don't want my child to get hurt. I don't want my child to have an accident with another kid in the house. And so that can be a great motivational interviewing tool.
I love that you're bringing up motivational interviewing, because it's been occurring to me as we're talking about this that the way in which the clinician is approaching the topic can have a big impact on how it's received by the patient, right? That I think for the patients I've worked with in the past, particularly those who, are there for either having had a suicide crisis or suicidal ideation, there's this concern that if they say too much about wanting to harm themselves, then I'm just going to insist on we just collect their guns and take them away and they can never have them back. Kind of this maybe an assumption, and perhaps even, not wrong from maybe experiences they've had in the past, that if they say too much, the first thing I'm gonna do is talk about let's take your guns away and you can never have them back. And so, meeting the client where they're at, thinking about what motivates them, and also really kind of approaching it with curiosity versus kind of like a directive kind of an approach, I think can be really important here. What are some of those tips you would have for clinicians who are needing to have this conversation with their client in order to maybe help it be received a bit better?
Well, your emphasis on meeting them where they are, I think that's, I say that over and over again. It is very important to, like you said, approach this with curiosity. I want to understand more about you as a person, as a patient. Okay, so you keep guns at home. Can you tell me about that? What are your reasons for owning a gun? The most common reasons that people will cite for owning a gun, there's really several, there's kind of the big three. One is self-protection, or protection of the home. Another would be sporting, right? So they're target shooting or they like to hunt. And then the third would be they're collectors. They're fascinated by these devices, by these machines, and they find tremendous beauty in them. Okay. Well, you can unpack each of those. So a person who wants to protect themselves or their family, well, I don't think we would take issue with somebody wanting to keep their house safe, right? Or protect their family. It's actually, most people would see that as very noble, and it's important to reflect that back to the patient. Now, at the same time, though, it then becomes a process of, well, are there risks that you're either not appreciating or that you're minimizing or ignoring? And I always use the example of, say, somebody lives out in a rural area, right? So say you've had a patient that lives out in the far suburbs of DC, and what's the police response time where they live? Well, maybe it's 20 minutes. That person might not have the same sense of safety as one of somebody like me who lives, in a fairly suburban area, and I'm pretty sure the police will be there in less than 5 minutes if I called. So that's a different perception of risk. Now, add to that, maybe they have neighbors that they're suspicious of engaging in criminal activity, right? So we know that crime doesn't just occur in urban areas. Drug labs exist out in very rural areas. So if that's your neighbor, you might feel more compelled to protect yourself. So I'm not, agree, disagree. That's not our role as a clinician, right? Our role is to help the patient then make choices that make their home as safe as possible. So now let's introduce that they're having conflict with their spouse, right? They have frequent arguments. Sometimes the arguments go to throwing things. Well, that's concerning to have firearms in the house, but let's see. How are those firearms secured, right? How are they stored? Oh, no, I keep it loaded in the nightstand because I don't know when I'm going to need to protect myself. Okay. I can see Corinne getting anxious, right? I mean, 'cause, and you should be.
Right.
You should be. And what makes you anxious?
Makes me anxious is now I got to have a discussion with them about this is a terrible idea. You shouldn't have it stored in your nightstand. And who's in danger and who am I responsible for and how am I going to change this? Right. So all of a sudden I feel this pressure. And I also suspect if I just say all of that to the client, that's not going to be very well received.
As a matter of fact, it will be very poorly
Yeah.
received, and they may just fire you and not
Right.
come back. And so, have we accomplished our mission if they never come back because they've been misunderstood? So it is the idea of, again, this is where motivational interviewing comes in, is help them, challenge them with, one misperceived risk, get them to focus on a particular area of risk that they hadn't considered before. Now, can they then evoke a desire to change? Right? So maybe they have a toddler. Okay. What's the likelihood that your toddler is going to find that gun? Oh, no. They know better, and it's put away where they won't find it. Well, what if I told you that 75% of kids, your child's age, have found the firearm in their house? They know exactly where it is. person's eyes get big, right?
Yeah,
And
right.
they say, whoa. And then you can also have a conversation, right? All of us remember when we were kids, we knew where stuff was hidden in the house, right?
Yeah.
So you can get people to relate to that. It's like, you were a kid too. How many things did you pick up that you weren't supposed to pick up when you were a kid? Now imagine if that was a loaded firearm,
Right.
right? So that tends to evoke a desire to change. And then it's, well, what are you willing to do? Where can we find that sweet spot between making your kids safe and you feeling protected? And maybe that's just, okay, I'm going to pull the magazine out and I'm going to put it in the drawer next to the gun. Well, okay. Is now here's the other thing, right? Can you, is it okay if you don't get the 100% solution?
That's what I was picking up on. It doesn't seem like this is all or nothing, right? Because it can't be. It can't be all or nothing if you want it, if you want the intervention to work.
Well, and you have to reassure yourself that you've done something to make the environment safer. And it may be that there is a process that the patient goes through, recognizing after a few weeks that, you know what? Yeah, I'm just as safe with it unloaded as I was with it, loaded. Maybe I'll get that lockbox. Maybe I will actually store the ammunition separately, or maybe I'll get a cable lock. It could be any number of things. And so just having respect for the process of change is really something that we have to get comfortable with.
I like what you said about kind of, that we've made some improvement to the safety in the environment. Because it occurs to me that, a lot of times, and certainly correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of times it seems like suicide crises are not long-lasting events. They can be seconds, they can be minutes, sometimes they can be hours. But the more steps that we can set up between having an impulse and acting on it, or how much delay we can get in there, seems to be really important about creating or improving safety and perhaps decreasing the likelihood of a suicide attempt.
So steps do several things, right? You're exactly right. They put time and space between the impulse and the fatal act, but they also create opportunities to choose another path.
Right.
So if the only action is picking up the gun and putting your finger on the trigger, there's one opportunity to change your mind. But if you have to unlock the box, if you have to insert the magazine, if you have to chamber the round, each of those is an opportunity to say, you know what? Maybe I'll just call my brother because I just need to talk to somebody. And that suicide crisis has passed.
Right.
Is the problem solved? Probably not. But is the person still alive to potentially work out the problem down the road? Yes.
Right.
Here's another thing I think we're going to have to get comfortable with as clinicians. That might happen, and the patient might never tell you that that happened.
Yeah.
Did you still do a good thing if you were part of the motivation to put that step in the way? I think it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems like a lot of things that we do clinically, we may never get the feedback
Right.
on.
Right.
And
Which is so ironic because, we with CBT, we're always talking about controlling the controllables. I mean,
right.
this is a big uncontrollable, but what can we control? We can control the environment that they've created. What happens once they're in that environment, we don't control.
Right.
Now you're getting into all my anxieties, Kurt. You're telling me I don't control everything? This is terrible news.
But the truth is, if you've done the right things and created the safer environment, the probability that that patient is going to survive is higher.
Is the goal, of course.
Right.
So I don't want to turn this into something negative because I feel like this is also important and positive, and I'm going to do it anyway. Our theme this season, Kurt, is talking about what are some of the missteps that sometimes we as clinicians make? And maybe that's because we're early in our careers and we don't have a lot of experience, or because this is an area that we're not as familiar with. And so we've been referring to this as the seven sins of EVP. And what we mean is, like, what are the most common things? So we're asking each of our guests to kind of nominate, if you will, or throw out there a possible, what is one of the seven sins of doing evidence-based interventions, particularly around the topic that we're talking about today? What are some of those most common errors that you see, maybe, or what's the most common error that you see with clinicians working with clients, whether it's they're in a current suicidal crisis or not, when we're approaching this area of firearm safety and lethal means safety?
I think probably the biggest sin I would perceive is kind of a very black and white thinking when it comes to firearms and risk. So if you start at sort of what I would consider the earliest developmental stage of understanding firearms and risk, it's there's either guns or no guns. So the patient can either have guns or they can't have guns. And I think that is a very, I think that's a message that when firearm owning patients hear that message, that's one of their worst fears, right? Is that they will come into us, talk to us, and we'll take away all of their guns. And it should be the furthest thing from the truth. Should a person in a suicidal crisis have access to a firearm in their home? Absolutely not. Should there be steps taken to secure that firearm and make their environment safe? Absolutely. But the vast majority of patients that we see aren't in that crisis, right? And so there has to be a more nuanced understanding of risk and a more nuanced discussion of how to mitigate those risks.
That's great. It feels even too like one of the maybe the subtext there too is that we need to be careful not to inflict our own value system, whatever that may be, around firearms access onto our clients, and instead work with them within their value system in a way that works for them.
I agree 100%. And I think that was really one of the motivators for creating the podcast, right? The podcast was not about gun safety, but it was about having conversations because these are challenging conversations. And what do we know about challenging conversations? If it's hard enough, people just won't do it. They'll avoid it. They'll talk about something else. And so we said, okay, let's look at some of these circumstances, these dyads, these relationships where a conversation about storing a firearm securely might make sense, might have the opportunity to save a life. And I will tell you, one of the conversations that was right up towards the top was the idea of we called the episode Doctors and Patients, but it's really any clinician and any patient. And so, but that's a small population to think about. And so, we thought about conversations between spouses, parents and teens, kids and their older adult parents.
I'll tell you, that's the one that really resonated with me. And I'll tell you, I was listening to that episode of, kids and their adult parents, particularly adult parents where perhaps dementia is starting and maybe progressing. I'm listening to that episode, Kurt, as I was helping to pack up my parents' stuff and move them to assisted living. And it really hit home because, to be honest, I wasn't sure if I was going to come across firearms in their home or not. And that was, an interesting moment even for myself to think about, what would I say? Like, how would I approach this? I assume in their assisted living place, their facility there, that would not be allowed. But at the same time, I think it would be an important conversation to have. So, I mean, personally relevant to me as I was listening to that in that moment, even. Great
Well,
conversations.
and for me, that was one of the great parts of the journey of making the podcast was, coming across somebody like Emmy Betts, who told us about this idea of a firearm legacy plan, right? So, how to sit down with your parents and have this conversation. Dad, how many guns do you have in the house? Is there anything I should know about these? What do you want to do when it's time to not have guns? What do I do with these? This one seems really special. It was passed down from your grandfather and it has this history associated with it. What do you want me to do? It's kind of a very focused type of estate planning, but it's around this difficult thing of, imagine walking into your parents' house and there's a cabinet full of hunting rifles, and you think to yourself, well, what am I going to do with those when they're gone?
Yeah, and that conversation is also empowering as opposed to, in my case, anxiety provoking, right? Approaching that conversation in that way, having an open dialogue of these guns are important to you. Let's come up with a plan for how to address them feels so different than perhaps my stereotype for how I might have approached that conversation previously.
I mean, let's be honest. Would you be freaking out about having a conversation with your mother about her art supplies? I don't think so. What do you want me to do with all this paint?
I
I
mean, I'm
don't.
much more concerned about the amount of Christmas decorations that she has, but point taken,
Yeah.
point taken.
And it might be riskier because you could end up buried under all of them. So.
Oh, this is a really helpful conversation. Obviously, I said from the outset, it's a conversation, it's a topic that I don't feel particularly competent in. So it's giving me the first steps to become more competent. And I think this is a good segue into talking about actionable intel for this episode, thinking about what our listeners can do, where they can go if they want more experience or more knowledge in this area. And so I'll throw out the first one because, as I said, I know what I'm doing later today, which is I'm going to check out bulletpointsproject.org, correct? And I'm going to become more knowledgeable about gun safety and gun firearm terminology, et cetera. So we're definitely going to link that in the show notes as a resource for folks who want to pursue that. Other items, actionable intel, things that our listeners can do now.
Sure. One of the things we did this years ago, and it's still available, but at the Center for the Study of Traumatic Stress, which is CSTSonline.org, we have fact sheets, and there's one that I would highlight in particular, which is it's conversations about firearm safety for primary care providers. And is basically it's a two-pager that gives you some points about a lot of the things that I've covered today with you, or that we've discussed today, about how to apply that motivational interviewing framework with your patients and getting them to create a safer environment in their home. Another piece of the puzzle is if I ask the question, and I do have some concern about risk, and I want the patient to get their firearms out of the home, what can I do? Right? Do I send the police to their house to, this is the other part. What do I do if I see that there's risk? Maybe it's not to the point where I need to involve law enforcement, but I'd feel better. I think the patient would feel better if the guns were out of their home. That's something that probably until the last few years, I don't think much of society has thought about. And so there is a terrific resource to be able to provide patients in terms of how to store their guns outside of the home if they don't know what to do with them. And that's a group called Pause to Protect. So it's pausetoprotect.org. And one of the great things about that resource, that website, is they keep an up-to-date map of where individuals can go to have their firearms stored outside of their home. It also has other useful advice for, say, they don't want to take it to a gun dealer or to some other secure location. It has that information about how to transfer it to a trusted friend or family member and understanding the laws in your state, because it is very important. And firearm owners know this, that you can't just transfer your firearms to anybody, that you actually
Right.
have responsibility as a gun owner to not allow unauthorized access to your guns. And so the last thing somebody in crisis wants to do is create another problem by doing an
Right.
illegal transfer of a
Right.
firearm,
Yeah.
or worse, to do a transfer of a firearm and then have that person do something illegal with it. So understanding those nuances, I think Pause to Protect is just a great resource to just spend a little time with and understand some of these concepts, but also how can you advise your patients and have a place for them to go? And gosh, wouldn't it be wonderful if, you see the patient 1 week and you talk about and you perceive some suicide risk and you say, hey, I think it might be a better environment if those guns are out of the house for a while. Have you thought about how you would do that? They have no clue. You give them this Pause to Protect information, and they come back the next week and tell you, you know what? You were right. It's just, this is a rough time. I know we're going to get through this, but I was actually able to, take my pistols over to this location and I transferred them, and it's all above board, and I feel good about it, and I feel safer now.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic. One other resource I think we should mention one more time is the Let's Talk About Your Guns podcast with Dr. Kurt West. That's available, I think, on pretty much all the major podcast platforms. Probably wherever you're listening to this podcast, it's available there too. So check that out. It's fantastic, fantastic podcast about these important conversations to have in the various contexts where they might show up.
Yeah. And I'll add one more, which is since we have talked a little bit about motivational interviewing today on this episode, I want to point out that at CDP, we do have some resources as well as future training in motivational interviewing. And maybe we'll link some of that in the show notes as well. So if you're not entirely familiar with that yet, you can do a little research on that too. Yeah. Well, I think we've given listeners and myself
I think just
some,
Corinne.
just me. I do feel a little bit better. We've given folks some resources to be better equipped to have this really important, if sometimes uncomfortable, conversation with patients. So
Yeah.
thank you so much, Kurt, for joining us. It's great to
Thank
have
you.
a USIS collaboration as well. We so rarely get to do that here at CDP. So it's fantastic to have you on. We're so grateful to have you here.
Thanks for
Well,
coming on.
thank you so much for having me. And it's again, it's really my hope that every one of us does our part to create safer environments.
With that, thank you, listeners, for checking in. Don't forget to send us your questions and comments on SpeakPipe or on our social media channels. We want to hear from you. We want to hear any questions you have. And until our next episode, stay curious.
And mind your EBPs.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Remember, we love hearing from our listeners, so leave us a message on SpeakPipe or send us an email. Both can be found in our show notes. Our theme music is Failed Attempts by Nitro, and our administrative assistant is Bree Mercer.
Thanks for listening to Practical for Your Practice.
If you like what you're hearing, please feel free to follow us, rate this episode, and share it with others.
Until next time.